Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. There are 65 million unpaid family caregivers in the United States today. And they range from adult children taking care of their aging parents to spouses taking care of an ill husband or wife. And the experience of caring for a loved one, well, it can be rewarding and even enriching, but it's also draining emotionally, isolating, often even disorienting. And caregivers often wind up developing their own set of physical and emotional problems of their own. My guest today is no stranger to the vast range of emotions and challenges that come with caregiving. Gail Sheehy lived through it herself. She spent 17 years taking care of her husband, who had succumbed to cancer. She's a journalist, a best-selling author, widely known for her Passages books. And her latest book is Passages to Caregiving, Turning Chaos into Confidence. Gail joins us today by phone from New York City. Gail, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Dan. Yes. Happy to be with you.
Before we get started, we want to make sure you stay with us after the show. We're going to have a live chat with Gail and myself about caregiving, and we'll be online to answer your questions. You can log on now if you like at whyy.org/voices. In the meantime, give us a call and share your experience and questions about being a caregiver. Our number, as always, is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, Gail, your story begins when you were in the hairdressers.
And I was in the what?
You were in the hairdresser.
Right.
And you got a call from your husband's doctor.
Right, exactly. Well, we were having a quite wonderful life. My husband was an editor and publisher of a New York magazine and later other publications, and I was a writer. I think I was on my ninth or tenth book at that time. And we were going to a concert that night, and suddenly this call came to me, and the man said, "It's not benign." And I could hardly place his voice, and then I remembered it sounded like my husband's oncologist, but I hadn't talked to him for 2 years. 2 years before he'd taken out a cyst on my husband's neck and pronounced it benign. He said, "It's cancer." I said, "But 2 years ago, when you took it out, you said it was..." He said, "I know. The pathologist recut the old slides. It's cancer." So we were, 2 years behind the eight ball to begin with. And it's that moment when you get the call about your mom who's, had a fall and maybe had a stroke that you certainly weren't expecting, or it's a call about your dad and he's, run a red light and hit somebody again, but you've never been able to talk him out of driving. So well, you're not even surely want to know whether it's his eyes or possibly his mind.
Well, Gail, it's funny. I read your book and I was moved back to my own experience. I was 24 years old, and we noticed that a mole on my wife's leg, and she was 20 years old, had begun to bleed. And, after a wild series of doctor visits, we found out that she had grade 3 melanoma, and we had a two-year-old child and a one-year-old child. And all of a sudden, like that phone call, all of a sudden I was a caregiver and I had no idea what that meant, but I was on some kind of automatic pilot. You know, I just knew what I needed to do one step after the other.
Well, you know, I went into reporter mode, Dan. Mm. And I think that's actually a pretty good mode for the sudden caregiver, because we know that the brain simply does not take in, you know, shocking news or in detail. So if you're going from doctor to doctor to, you know, try to get to the bottom of strange symptoms, certainly the person who is ill is not going to hear accurately. And even the person who is trying to take notes is probably not going to get them all down, because it comes too fast. Doctors have a very short time. They, you know, rattle off a lot of medical lingo that we're not you know, aware of.
Well, and the other factor is, when we are experiencing trauma, that level of anxiety, we are hearing impaired.
Absolutely.
We can't integrate information.
Yeah, so what I did was to ask doctors if I could tape record the conversation. And actually, I found that they very few minded, because they knew you were going to be calling and bugging them later to repeat what they'd said. And actually transcribing it afterwards, when you're a little bit more, you know, calm, and you get all the detail, it empowers you, because you feel like, okay, now I know exactly the right words to use when I call the next doctor and say, you know, what do you think about this? Because I found the hardest thing in the first phase, shock and mobilization, was to compare the different, often differing diagnoses, but certainly different treatment options. And finally, I think you want to look for what I call a medical quarterback. And that would be the ideal doctor, the one you trust the most. And if you ask him three questions, or her, and if they give you at least two positive answers, you found one. And that is, will you help us decide among treatment options? Will you help us assemble the care team? Because there's usually maybe two, three doctors, maybe several complementary medicine people. And third, will you help us address pain or any other side effects of treatment?
I think they're critical questions, and the information that gives you ultimately is a sense of whether that doctor is able or willing to take what I call a sense of ownership in this. And you know, once we have found that, I think we can take a deep breath.
So, well, I found that actually one doctor used the word partnership. We're entering into a partnership.
Yeah.
And that was the magic word.
Sure.
So I use that in subsequent cancer diagnoses to say, would you be willing to be our partner? I'll be a part of it as the caregiver, and my husband is the patient.
Let me just for a minute come back to my experiences as caregiver. It was acute. It lasted a year of surgery, of chemotherapy, of depression. It was exhausting, and it was a year.
Mm.
It was, fortunately, she was okay. It was acute.
Wow.
I mean, the psychological after effects, you know, lasted for years, but it was acute scenario. But this, most caregiving, according to the research you cite in your book, is not 1 year. Most research, most caregiving goes to chronic. You've got a chapter called Tag You're It. So what happens, start in your case, when you began to realize this was not an acute crisis but a long haul? Tell us about the transition inside your own mind.
Well, in that first battle with cancer, finding the right doctor, deciding on the treatment, and then going for radical neck surgery and radiation beforehand. And once we were, you know, there was enormous reserves are called upon, and all your stress chemicals come pouring out, and they serve you very well in that sprint period. And I found that once the treatment was all over, my husband began to lapse into a kind of a mild depression. Because everybody else, you know, rallies to the cause and you know, pays a great deal of attention to you, to the patient, and even to the caregiver. And then everybody else goes back to their own lives and picks up where they left off. But you really can't, because if you've had cancer, and anybody knows it, you may not be able to go back to exactly the same life because you're marked as having a shortened shelf life. And particularly if you're older, my husband was already in his 60s, he wasn't going to be able to raise money for another magazine. And that impacted my life as well. And as I saw him, you know, as I asked professionals, was this a normal reaction? They said, yes, it is, because when you're in active fighting mode, you know, everything is very exciting. You're in battle. And then when the treatment stops, there's just this whole uncertainty out there. Did it work? Is it going to come back? What can I do? You know, the doctor says he'll see me in 3 months. So we finally settled into a new normal. And then the next phase, I think, is if the illness continues or recurs, I call it boomerang. And that's when there is either the original illness roars out of hibernation like an animal, or there's a complication, or there's another. Something else goes wrong.
And that happened with you and Clay.
Yes, it did. We were in another doctor's office 2 years later when we were told that he had a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. But it was indolent, which sounded good. And the doctor surprised us by saying, I'm not going to treat you because any drug that we have now is not going to really prolong your lifespan, and it's usually going to be another 10 years. And the best thing you can do is for the two of you to go out and do something wonderful that you wouldn't have dared before, and do it together. So we walked out of that doctor's office on a cloud.
I want to know what happened to you, Gail, once you realized that not only was this going to be long haul, but it was going to be for the rest of his life. You were going to be his caregiver. Tell us about that transition inside your own mind, heart.
I think at that point I said, you know, we have to really make a major change in life. There's somehow, between the two of us, we have to come up with another act for Clay that's going to excite him and make his life worth fighting for. It would be too easy to just kind of sit back and, you know, take medicine and, you know, sort of dribble out the last years. So if I was going to, you know, be sharing my life with him, it was only going to be vital if we found something that would really excite him and that I could live with as well. So I began, I had some help from Larry Leshan, who had written a book called Cancer as Turning Point. And I think it often can be a turning point because, you know, it sounds like a death sentence, but it certainly doesn't have to be and ordinarily isn't today. So what we did was walk around. We took walks every weekend in a nature preserve and kept on chewing on the same problem. What was it that Clay loved to do, absent of status and title and particular, you know, company? What was it he really loved to do about his work? And it took him a year to hit on it. And suddenly he said, I love to identify and shape young talent. And for the first time, that suggested a special kind of a teaching situation where he could actually be working with young journalists and having them do new magazines. At the same time, another thing was going on, which I strongly recommend, which is a circle of care, letting other people know who are close to you, colleagues, friends, even neighbors, that, you know, you need some help. And a group of people who had worked with Clay and whose careers he had fostered began meeting regularly over the course of a year to figure out where they could get Clay back in action again. They went to colleges and universities to explore what kind of a program they might be willing to set up that Clay could teach. Now, everybody can't do that, but there may be some area in in one's professional life where they could do teaching, mentoring, giving back that would appeal to them.
Yeah, I think the difficulty, I don't know if everybody can't do that. I mean, certainly not using the model you and Clay used, but, you know, there are support networks out there. You know, Native Americans, that's what they do when there's a crisis. They mobilize, they find out what the remaining skill set is, and then, you know, they figure out who can help them, you know, achieve what they want to achieve in whatever time they have left, whether it's weeks or years. So the model is out there and it's accessible, hopefully, to lots of people. But I want to switch gears with you for a minute. And there's a lot of many caregiver situations out there, and they range from your own experience, which was caring for Clay, who ultimately had a terminal illness, to middle-aged caregivers caring for elderly parents. And then there's a category that's near and dear to my heart, and that's a category of caregivers caring for people with chronic illness and disability, something that is just not going to go away for a long time. Mm-hmm. Do you see the issues being the same?
Well, actually, that was what happened to us. Clay had cancer 4 separate different times, and each time he got over it. And at the end, in the last 3 years of his life, he didn't have cancer, but he had chronic conditions that were the result of treatment for cancer. And I think that happens to many people. Certainly, you know, most major illnesses now turn into some kind of a chronic problem,
mm-hmm.
whether it's heart disease, and there have been various, you know, interventions, but there's still a buildup of restrictions, certainly any of the autoimmune diseases, any of the cognitive problems, Parkinson's, and so on. So you turn into a chronically ill person. And you can't be cured in an acute care hospital, but that's where you're sent. That's how our system, our reimbursement system, works. And so people go to emergency rooms, which are no place for somebody who's elderly or with chronic illness, and then you get admitted. And each time you're admitted, the hospital and the doctor gets paid, and oftentimes you come home more debilitated because hospitals are, you know, give you what they want to give you. They don't base it on the goals or wishes of the patient. The other alternative is going to hospice, but, you know, most chronically ill people aren't ready for hospice until the last 6 months of their life. So that's not a ready option. And in between, what I call the in-between stage, can last for years or even decades. And that's where I think our healthcare system has been completely negligent.
Yeah, you talked about the caregivers being the backbone of a broken healthcare system. Gail, before we go to break, there are major differences between the way men and women deal with being a caregiver. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, men are often administrative. They'll take on the, you know, I'll read the insurance policy, I'll, you know, write the checks for mom or dad's bills, you know, I'll call and check into the situation on the ground where you could get help to come into the house, but they're not usually involved hands-on. That role is usually expected to fall to women. And many women don't even see it as a role. It's the biggest obstacle of all, which is that women think, well, this is just what we do as a daughter or as a wife. But today, caregiver is a professional-level role. If you think about it, you know, somebody's in the hospital over the course of 24 hours, they may be seen by 24 different people, including the, you know, IV nurse and the breathing specialist and the nutritionist and, you know, various interns.
Sure.
And then suddenly the person is sent home and it's all on one person who isn't trained. So we have to really understand that we become professionals, and how do we empower ourselves? How do we learn the role? and how do we present ourselves to doctors and nurses and hospital personnel as a, you know, a professional who wants to be part of the collaborative team.
When we've got to take a short break, Gail, and when we come back, I want to talk about caregivers and their health and what happened to you over the course of this journey. My guest today is Gail Sheehy. She's a journalist, best-selling author. Her latest book is called Passages in Caregiving, Turning Chaos into Confidence. Stay with us after the show. We're going to have a live web chat about caregiving with Gail. You can log in at whyy.org/voices. But we'd like to hear from you now. Are you a caregiver? Have you had experience at being a caregiver? Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We'd love to hear from caregivers, family caregivers, ideally. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
Lourdes Emergency Department at Deborah is a proud supporter of WHYY. Now open, the region's newest emergency department located at Deborah Heart and Lung Center. Operated by an experienced team from Lourdes Medical Center of Burlington County, their new location will offer both ambulance and walk-in patients with access to specialized emergency care. 1-888-LOURDES or lourdesnet.org. Celebrating the opening of the new emergency department and commitment to care for Burlington County and beyond.
The vocoder is responsible for the otherworldly robotic sound hip-hop fans love, and these days it's almost ubiquitous.
But you may not know about its surprising military past. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot, and this week on Sound Opinions we talk to author Dave Tompkins about the vocoder's fascinating history and contributions to pop music.
Tune in to Sound Opinions
tonight at 9 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking with best-selling author Gail Sheehy. Her latest book is called Passages in Caregiving, Turning Chaos into Confidence. And this book also includes her own experience of caring for her husband, Clay, for 17 years until he passed away from cancer-related illness. Gail, we talked about caregivers' health and how it declines as the stress of caregiving is one of the greatest stresses there is, losing sleep, maintaining a job, often being a parent at the same time. Most caregivers I have spoken with secretly wish somebody to come in and take care of them.
Right. You're absolutely right. Well, I think we become exhausted, but we can't sleep because we are hypervigilant. We're always on call. We're always thinking, you know, if I don't keep one eye open, something drastic is going to happen. And gradually that wears down our immune system. You know, you're pouring out this cortisol all the time until it overrides the immune system, so you're at risk for any kind of a illness or infection. You get muscle and joint problems, and depression is very common among caregivers. I didn't even recognize it until my husband's doctor did, and he ordered me to go away. I think the biggest mistake that we make as caregivers is we think we can't take breaks. We think we can't take long weekends or vacations. The fact is, we have to. You know, anybody burns out after, you know, a year at this. Yet hotlines for caregivers don't usually get that call that says, I can't do this anymore, until a caregiver has been at it for 3 or 4 years. They're really at burnout at that point. Wouldn't you agree?
I would agree. Let me tell you what I hear very often. Well, I can't take time for myself. I have no time. I have no resources. I don't have enough support network? Or how can I take time when they are suffering? How dare I go out and enjoy myself when they're laying in bed and can't move? And I must have heard 8 or 10 other excuses like that. But well, how do you answer that?
I think one of the best answers is to hook up with another caregiver and reinforce each other. I found two women just like that when I finally went, after 5 years of caregiving without any break, I went to a health ranch that I used to go to, and the first thing I found out was that after very, very early dinner at the, central lodge, I could hardly walk back to my room without wanting to lay down. And I'm talking about like 7:30 at night. So I realized, being usually a very energetic person, that I had just been, my batteries were almost dead. And I couldn't afford to not go away to recharge myself at least once a year. And I was hiking the next morning behind two women in their late 40s, both of whom had been caring for one for a mother, one for a husband, for several years. And they had barely knew each other, but they found out they were both in the caregiving life and coaxed each other to go on this retreat. And one of them was saying, yes, but I noticed you threw up on the plane. You were so feeling so guilty. And the other one said, well, just as I was leaving my mother's hospice team came to me and said, you can't go away without giving us the burial plans for your mother. What if she dies while you're away?
Oh, that'll do it.
It didn't, actually. She went to see her mother. She couldn't find the burial plans, and she saw her mother and sat beside her bed. She was in the hospital on a morphine drip, and her eyes were at half-mast. And she said, Mom, I visited you every day, and I just love you so much, and for a year I've been coming to see you. And
she got permission.
But I have to go away to take care of myself, and so I'll be in Mexico for a week, so don't die. And her mother's eyes flew open, and she came awake and said, that's what I want for you.
Yeah, I think that's what most of those who are on the receiving end really do want that. I remember when I was being cared for, I wanted my wife to leave. I felt so guilty about all the burden I was causing her. On the other hand, right. I was afraid of her leaving. I want to switch gears here for a second.
Okay.
Gail, as you know, there's been a lot of public criticism about your book, and some find your suggestions for caregivers to take a trip, like you said, or hire a geriatric care manager aren't attainable for most, and require having money. I want to read you an email I received from one of our listeners. Her name is Trish. She was upset about your book, and I want to read you an excerpt from her email.
Okay.
She said, what if you were a clerk at a 7-Eleven with a GED living from paycheck to paycheck in Smallville, USA? What if you were a 35-year-old dad with 4 kids and a wife that was ventilator-dependent, a C2 quadriplegic? I don't think you could relate to this book at all. That's my big problem with the book. It's like caregiving strategies for the highly educated, affluent, rich, famous, and connected. I'm not saying it's all bad. Certainly some of the thoughts, words, and feelings are right. But frankly, I get agitated reading it. There's no way that average Joe Public could pull off many of her tips. Now, let me tell you about what I know of Trish. She, in fact, is taking care of a husband who is a C2 vent-dependent quadriplegic with some closed head injury, so his cognition is not clear. She's got kids, and she's got to work full-time.
How old is she?
She's probably 40.
Well, that's a drastic and somewhat unusual situation. I mean, it's about as drastic as you can get. If there's both cognition problems, a person who is really immobilized, and she's very young, and she has children. That kind of thing is happening to veterans, and many of whom aren't married, so that mom and dad are back in a caregiving role when they're maybe only in their 40s.
Right, and these are people that can't go away on vacation and maybe don't even have the resources to go away for a weekend. And if they do, they don't have the resources to get someone in there to care for their loved one while they do.
Well, you know, there are two things I can say about that. One is that if the patient is on Medicaid, which I imagine they would be if they were quadriplegic, there is a provision in the Medicaid law that extends, you know, a respite benefit to the caregiver for 4 or 5 days every 3 months. So the problem is to try to find a respite care place. Usually it's a nursing home or a rehab facility. But they are required by law to provide a place where you can take your loved one for 4 or 5 days and get away. Maybe you just get away at home so that you can rest and, you know, do some things for yourself that you, that need catching up. But that's essential. I mean, to maintain the health of the caregiver, it's essential that someone get, you know, 4 or 5 days away at least every few months away from the hypervigilance and the strain of it. The second thing is that for veterans now, there is a provision in the new health care law that they, too, can get help taking care of the person at home. So the caregiver can get away. The other thing is to, you know, it takes a village. Somebody who is working at a 7-Eleven in Smallville, USA, and has dad on a ventilator, maybe can, work with other people who are, you know, colleagues, coworkers, to do something for them that you can do when you're home. At night, something you do better. Maybe you do, you know, email better. Maybe you know how to set up a website. Maybe you know another language. But to barter with skills that you might have with other coworkers who might be able to come over and, you know, visit your loved one or pick up a prescription or make some calls on the day that you're on or the night that you're on to, you know, back to doctors and offices that where you have to follow up to make the next thing happen.
It certainly is a much harder life and a much harder go of it when you don't have resources. And there are support networks out there for caregivers that you can reach out to. I met Trish at the Christopher Reeve website, which is a tremendous support for caregivers. It doesn't give answers. It doesn't change a difficult life into one that's less difficult. But, you know, it does give you access to kindred spirits, which is terribly important.
It is. Well, there's also, you know, the Area Agency on Aging, which is in every county and in many towns. The first stop. And they call it a AAA, Area Agency on Aging. You can go on to the Elder Care Locator on AARP and find your local one by putting in your zip code. They often have a care manager, not a private pay geriatric care manager, but a care manager who really knows the system and knows the local resources. And that person will give you local resources, local caregiving organizations, to find out if you can, afford to hire somebody to come in part time.
That's a good resource. I want to reintroduce you and go to the phones. We're talking with Gail Sheehy. Her latest book is called Passages in Caregiving: Turning Chaos into Confidence. Our number is 888-477-9499. Give us a call if you are or have been a caregiver. That's 888-477-9499. Let's go to the phones. We've got a lot of people who want to join the conversation, Gail. We've got Gary. We don't. We lost Gary. The issue of expense is a big deal.
Certainly is.
And if you're on Medicare, nursing homes, not all the nursing homes are the best in the world. You can't hire outside help if you're on Medicare. You certainly have less options.
Well, you can hire outside help. I mean, Medicare doesn't provide long-term care at home. And that comes as a shock to many people. If a person comes out of a hospital, Medicare will send a visiting nurse to assess the situation and possibly provide somebody to give occupational therapy, physical therapy, even speech therapy if it's needed. But that will only last for 2, maybe 3 weeks. And then you're on your own, which is where it really becomes shocking. Medicaid is really reserved for people who have no more than $2,000 in countable assets. And the problem there is if it's a spouse, the caregiving spouse and all of his or her savings are up for grabs to pay for the medical bills or home health aids for the person who needs care. And that can just wipe out both people.
We've got to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about a recommendation you made in your book about caregivers seeking spirituality. And oftentimes there is nothing more crushing to one's sense of spirituality than trauma. So I'd like to talk about that when we get back.
Okay.
My guest is Gail Sheehy. She's best-selling author, journalist. Her latest book is called Passages in Caregiving, Turning Chaos into Confidence. Hey, stay with us after the show. We're going to do a live web chat with Gail and myself. And our web chat, you can find it at whyy.org/voices. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
If you or someone you love is one of the 236 million people in the United States living with diabetes, join me, Chef Jim Coleman, and registered dietitian Lauren Swan for a live web chat on Thursday, June 10th at noon. We'll take the mystery out of reading food labels and give you delicious recipes. So this Thursday at noon, log on to whyy.org/chef and join the chat.
The International World Cup tournament kicks off in South Africa in the coming days, drawing hundreds of thousands of players, tourists, and journalists from around the world. That group includes a group of young reporters from Florida's A&M. We'll hear what they make of Africa's first World Cup. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking with Gail Sheehy about caregiving. Her latest book is Passages in Caregiving, Turning Chaos into Confidence. Gail, we talked about spirituality, and I had said that trauma can crush spirituality. You know, it forces us to, many people to ask questions, you know, why me? You know, life isn't fair. Maybe there is no one or nothing out there and everything's meaningless. And I think these questions are pretty normal and natural in the wake of trauma.
Well, they are. And I find that for caregivers, one of the biggest traps is to begin playing God, to begin to think that you are the person responsible for saving your loved one day to day from, you know, mistakes and cross medications and, you know, rushing them to the ER and being on top of everything. And the problem with that is that if, as long as things are going well and, you know, and probably you do save them from some very, you know, near disasters, you know, your ego is stimulated and you feel empowered and it's a good feeling. But when something goes wrong or the old illness comes back or there's a recurrence or something else happens, If you're playing God, you're going to think it's your fault, and that's going to be a real trip down. And it took me a long time to break myself of that, you know, mistaken impression. And I was out of spiritual conditioning. I told one of my friends who was a doctor, I was exercising pretty religiously, which is important, but not I really kind of lost touch with my religious upbringing, and so she suggested I try 12-step meeting in a church, and I did, and that all the 12-step meetings really have the same basis, which is to tell, you know, remind you that there is a God, you're not it, and there's a power greater than yourself that to whom you can turn things over when they're too much for you. And caregiving becomes too much for us.
Yeah, and I think the heart of the issue of caregiving comes from Niebuhr's prayer, which is commonly known as the AA prayer. You know, it's God grant me the serenity. I mean, we have to know what we can do and what we can't do, mm-hmm. and kind of make peace with what we can't do. I agree with you. I love the idea when I read about you joining a 12-step program, because especially for programs like Al-Anon and Naranon for spouses and friends of people with substance abuse, the whole work of the program is about being able to let go and give up responsibility for things you can't do and care for yourself.
Well, and I think I took it beyond that in the book, as I used a metaphor for the caregiving journey, the labyrinth. It's a circle with a path that goes around and around to the center, and then if you continue following it, it brings you back out. And my understanding of the caregiving passage, since it was long in my case, 17 years off and on, was that once you come to the center, you have to grapple with the question, is my loved one going to come back to the same independent person he or she once was? And if the answer is probably not, but that they are going to become more and more dependent and needy, you, the caregiver, are on a different path. You need to begin preparing a path for yourself to come back to life. Otherwise, you may become so, you know, tied up with the person who is sick and ultimately going to pass on that you will enter a void at the end of his or her life.
Well, Gail, it turns out we've got Gary back on the line. Remember the Gary we missed a few minutes ago?
Hello.
We've got him back online. I have a feeling his question fits with right what you're talking about, Gail. Hi, Gary.
Hi. Well, I'm listening to your show, and we have a lot of parallels, Ms. Sheehy and I. I'm wondering if she went through different stages of emotion as to the same way I did, finding out the diagnosis of my wife, who I cared for solely. We didn't want to involve our daughter because she was at high school age and didn't want to bring her into this. But initially you're in shock and you're trying to find out which doctors to go to. Then you have some confusion, you know, getting things set up. And then you have anger issues, not towards each other, but I would have anger issues towards other people. Never with my wife, always she was number one. And, you know, you want to give her as much tender care, but firm care is possible, because sometimes she was stubborn. And then you have any anger in myself manifested into a point where I could not handle other people, what I thought were other people's inconsistencies or deficiencies. I wouldn't have any patience for them. And that might have been, they might have been fine. I might have been the one out of line. And then towards the end, when you know that there's no more treatment for her, I was wondering if you found that you had the emotion of elation. I never admitted that to anybody else before, but, you know, like last month of her life, I was happy that she was going to die because of the pain that she was in and discomfort. And we never put her in hospice. She died at our home. And, you know, I just felt, I felt like when she died, it was a Jefferson Hospital emergency room. Yeah. She and I were in the ambulance together. When she passed away, after I said the Shema to her, which is the prayer we say, I just felt, I took a deep breath and like, I was like, oh, you know, like, finally she's out of her pain.
Gary,
I wonder if that's normal.
Yeah. Gary, you talked about the stages leading up to her death. Tell us what happened to you after she died.
Oh, I had I had a breakdown.
Mm. What do you mean?
We had our own business for 20-some years in South Philly on a corner. We owned a corner store.
Yeah.
And it involved me 7 days a week. And my house was right next to the store, so it was very convenient that way. You know, I could run over and give her an Ensure to drink, you know, make her drink it. And we had a lot of humor in our caregiving back and forth. We had a lot of humor.
Gary, I hate to do this to you. This is killing me. I'm listening to your story, and I want to spend an hour with you, and I got one eye on the clock here. Tell us what happened to you after she died. You said you had a breakdown. What do you mean?
Well, I ran the store after she died, and I just couldn't. There was just no more fun in it anymore. And I wanted to meet another woman, so I went on a J date, and I met another woman, and she's delightful, and I'm with her now. But a woman didn't want you, like my wife wanted me going 7 days a week till 10:30 at night every day. So, I wasn't making that much money, and like I said, I used to run over my wife. It was a lot of fun. It was a neighborhood kind of place, and it just she was gone out of it.
Gary,
so I just can't handle it anymore.
Gary, thank you so much for your call, and I'm so happy you're with somebody who brings you some joy. Gail, I'd love to hear your reaction to what Gary said.
Well, it's a very, very tender and common story. I had a slightly different story. Certainly, the shock, the confusion, the anger with other people. You lose patience with, why can't you fix it? I've talked to many caregivers that way. Often the doctor, if they're really good, will say, hey, wait a second, back off. You need to go away for a weekend and let us take care of your wife or your mom or your dad. And that's why I say it's essential to take breaks. Otherwise, you just become difficult to deal with. You're not really helping your patient because you're alienating the people who you need to take care of them. And you're doing harm to yourself. When you get to towards the in-between stage where I was told by a doctor, don't bring your husband back to the hospital anymore. He keeps reinfecting himself. And I said, where do we go? And he said, I don't have any answers. And I looked into a hospice program, but they were just going to keep my husband in a unit and, you know, gradually withdraw feeding and hydration, and it was like speed dying, and he was nowhere near that. So what I found was palliative care, and I love to talk about that because most people don't know about it, but it is for the stage before hospice, and it can be from the moment of a life-limiting diagnosis. Some of the better cities and better hospitals have home health palliative care teams where you have a visiting nurse who comes regularly, a doctor that you, the caregiver, stay in touch with who oversees the treatment. But the goal is to put the power back in the hands of the patient. What are the patient's goals at this time of life? And if it were Gary's wife, she would have been able to tell the palliative care doctor who would ask her, what are your goals for this stage of life? She might have been able to say, I'm in so much pain, unless we can alleviate this, I don't really want to live much longer.
Yeah. Tell us, we've only got another minute or so left. Tell us about, as Gary was going towards the end, how did you two say goodbye to each other? What was that like for you?
Well, we had a wonderful doctor from Mount Sinai who helped us walk through that. And Clay was able to say what he needed in the last months of his life. He needed to continue to go out and see what's going on in the world because he was a journalist. So no matter what it took, car service or, you know, wheeling him down Broadway through crowds to get to a show on a discount, or just taking him to the park. I managed to get him out every day. And towards the end, when he asked the doctor, how much time do I have? And he said, not just weeks. I said, do you want to do something wonderful? Jazz? Because he was a great jazz lover. And I said, how about we go to a show? And I found there was a show that night, and I ran back to him, and I said, do you think we can get ready in a couple of hours? And he literally pulled together enough energy to get himself out of the bed and into a wheelchair and moved to the closet, put on his own jacket and a cap. And we went to the jazz concert and club, and he drummed on the table like he did as a boy, as a drummer. We had a wonderful evening.
Gail, that's a wonderful story on which to end our discussion. I want to thank you so much for joining us, and I look forward to chatting with you during our web chat, which is coming up in just a few minutes. And you'll be here this evening. You're going to be joining us at WHYY's Coming of Age and Boomer Vision program. That's going to be here at WHYY Studios at 6:30. The program starts at 7 o'clock. So we look,
that should be exciting.
We look forward to seeing you here.
Good.
All right, Gail. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Bye bye.
Bye.
My guest has been Gail Sheehy. She's written Passages in Caregiving, Turning Chaos into Confidence. And like I said, she's going to be joining us. Log in at whyy.org/voices. And if you want any more information about tonight's program, call 215-351-0511. Again, that's 215-351-0511. Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be talking about the meaning of fatherhood and the expanded role our friends can play in our children's lives. Well, if you want to reach us, we're at voices@whyy.org. And I can be reached at www.drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is executive producer of audio content at WHYY. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Stephanie Marudas is our producer. And today, I've got some sad news. We're saying goodbye to our producer, Gita Simons, who's leaving the show to produce something else, family. She's going to have another baby, and we're going to miss her terribly. She did a wonderful job for us. She was a good friend to the show, and she is a good friend to me. Gita, we will talk to you. Evan Pliss is our intern for the summer. Welcome aboard. And me? Forgot about me. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.